You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. We'd like to thank ZipRecruiter, Casper, and Sanebox for their continued support of Spycast. You'll hear more about these great companies later, but first, let's meet our guest.
We're excited, especially on today, which we'll talk about in a second, to have Duane Evans here with us. He's a former CIA operations officer with field tours in four continents, including serving as a chief of station, which, as many of you know, is CIA's most senior field position. He is a recipient of the Intelligence Star for Valor and the Career Commendation Medal. And prior to joining the agency, he was a U.S. Army Special Forces and military intelligence officer. He's a graduate of the New Mexico State University, go Aggies, I guess, and is the author of a novel, North from Calcutta, as well as Foxtrot in Kandahar, a memoir of a CIA officer in Afghanistan at the inception of America's longest war. Welcome, Duane. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at the Spy Museum.
Thank you for having me.
So when anyone writes a memoir, especially somebody who is a former practitioner, the question tends to be why, and even more so with this book, because this is not just a memoir of your life. It's not, you know, when I was born. It's really a memoir of a very particular time in your history. It's a snapshot of a specific period. So why focus specifically on this time and not, you know, hey, it's a 400-page book about my life and my childhood?
Yeah, good question. I feel for the reasons you stated that it's a special time. It was a very special time. For me, it was a very emotional time. The whole catalyst for my involvement in Afghanistan were the 9/11 attacks, which today, of course, is the anniversary of. And it was such a powerful experience for me that I knew I wanted to write about it, if only for myself, if only for maybe my family to read about it. But as years passed, even though I had written an initial spine of the story, just for my own remembrance, as the years passed and we continued to be involved in Afghanistan, and I realized how important the story was to me, and I began to see it as from a human interest standpoint, that it might be of interest to other people, as well as from the standpoint of being a historical account of a very special time. The whole involvement of the CIA in Afghanistan in that initial period was kind of unique, and it was under extraordinary circumstances. And for those reasons, I thought I could write something that just focused exclusively on that and not go into all the other things right. That you mentioned.
We have a lot of authors who are former practitioners who come to the museum or they're on the podcast, and many of them have nightmare stories about the publication review board at CIA. You actually talk about operations here. You talk about, let's use the current sources and methods in certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. But you had very little trouble getting this through the PRB. Can you talk a little about how that happened? Because there are certainly others that might want to know how you had a successful PRB experience. But also, was it purposeful when you were writing it? Were you trying to figure out what could you say and what couldn't you?
Definitely it was purposeful because I didn't want to run into a lot of problems with the PRB. And I'd seen other books, and I had a good sense of what the Publications Review Board is looking for in terms of what they would censor out. And they're looking at it from the standpoint of classified information, and particularly regarding protection of sources and methods. So I wrote the book in a way that I think I protected sources and methods, and it was the nature of the operations we were doing in Afghanistan at the time weren't your classic espionage operations. We weren't, you know, the book isn't really about running agents, running assets, receiving intelligence reporting. Some of that was going on, but that I didn't focus on that because that wasn't the main theme of the book, or the main thing that we were doing for that matter. So because it was a paramilitary operation for the most part, and a lot of this became public anyway, mm-hmm. and over this is now 16 years after the fact. So there's been some other things written, although most of that dealt with the North. Most of the things that were written about Afghanistan those days dealt with the North. And so the South hadn't been written about, and because some of these things had already been approved dealing with the North, usually the policy with PRB is if it's been approved, something similar has been approved by them, then if you write about it, even though they may initially say you can't do it, if you can point to them and say, but you allowed this other book to publish this and it was fine, they will reconsider and allow you to publish that in your book.
Well, you brought up 9/11 and how could you not, right? I mean, the anniversary of it. And there's very few young people in here, so just about everybody probably remembers where they were on 9/11. You were a block from here.
That's correct.
On 9/11, actually, at the FBI headquarters. Already kind of talking about some of the same concerns that everyone would be talking about a couple hours later. Can you talk a little bit about your experience that day?
Sure.
And how you and others kind of started seeing the writing on the wall long before the American public did.
Yeah. Well, on 9/11, it's really interesting. Like I say, I was only a block or so from here, a couple blocks from here. I was at the FBI headquarters building, and there's a gentleman in the audience here, a very dear friend of mine, who happened to be with me, who I talk about in the book. And I didn't know he was going to be here, but he has showed up. But I'll just call him Frank. Frank is an FBI special agent. And I was on leave on the day of 9/11 in 2001. And I'd just come back from overseas a few weeks before, and I actually had the benefit of being on a very extended leave because I had a lot of accumulated leave. So I was looking at a long leave period. In fact, I wasn't supposed to go to work until late October, and that was going to be at the FBI as a CIA liaison officer. And Frank, who had been working with me overseas, had brought up a foreign delegation to visit the FBI and to take to CIA headquarters as well for a briefing on the threat of international terrorism. And Frank invited me to join him at FBI headquarters to see this group, some of whom I knew, this Latin American delegation, and get a tour of the building. And I thought, as I was going to be a liaison officer in a couple months, quite a great opportunity. Plus, I wanted to see Frank. I hadn't seen him now in a month or two since I left the station where we'd worked together. So Frank and I, who had gone through a lot together already, we ran CT operations, counterterrorist operations overseas, and we had other very dramatic experiences that we went through that are mentioned in the book. He met me outside. I was sipping a cappuccino, enjoying the weather just like today, beautiful day, and I was thinking how good life was, and waiting for Frank to show up with his delegation. So I met them there. We went up to the FBI headquarters, up into their operations center, and we got there around 9 o'clock, and we couldn't find the person we were supposed to meet, and soon we were asked to escort the foreign delegation out of the operations center, that there was had been an incident in New York, a plane hit the building. We assumed it was a small plane. We went downstairs, and we went to the cafeteria to figure out what are we going to do now that we're not going to have this tour and this briefing. And that's when we saw the news report, saw the television for the first time. We saw what was really going on and realized right then, okay, this is something major, much bigger than what I think either one of us had imagined. And it was, you know, quite a shock, as it was to everyone. And I knew at that moment, when the second plane hit the building, I knew that this was Al-Qaeda. I instantly knew that. There was no question in my mind who had done it. And I knew it would mean we were going to go to a war, that we would be in a war soon. And I knew I had to be part of that.
Because you had been focused on counterterrorism for years at this point. You another interesting kind of you were there in a weird time story in the book is a month before the African embassy bombings in 1998,
right.
You were actually at one of the African embassies talking about how bad the security was.
That's correct. I happened just by chance, had visited that, the one in Nairobi, actually. I was in Nairobi, Kenya, and talking to an embassy officer there about their poor security, that the physical security of the embassy. And we happened to be standing in the exact spot where a truck bomb would later, a month later, was going to detonate and kill a lot of people. And I was overseas at the time when that attack happened, and I was back at the my station I'd left from when I went out to visit in Africa. And I saw the newspaper that morning, and I saw the graph of the picture of where the bomb had gone off, and I realized instantly I knew exactly where that place was. That was the place I'd visited, and that was the place I and the embassy officer had stood. So yeah, I was familiar with terrorism for some time.
Well, it's interesting what the embassy officer said to you. He understood that there were security issues.
Oh, absolutely. It wasn't a surprise to them. They knew about it more than I did, and they had requested, the ambassador there had made requests to the State Department to move locations. This has been going on for some time because of the security vulnerabilities of the embassy. And the officer told me at that moment, he said, yeah, we know it's vulnerable, but they're not going to do anything. He said, the ambassador has requested this, but there's not going to be any changes done until this building is blown down. And a month later, it was blown down.
You had mentioned that immediately by watching the TV coverage about 9/11 that you knew that we were at war. And most people understand that essentially the CIA ramped up immediately for the what would be called the global war on terror, for whatever words you want to use.
Right.
And certainly everyone attempted to ramp up as quickly as they could, but there's bureaucracy that started getting in the way. And one of the biggest issues that you outline in the book is that the Near East and South Asian Division, or the NE Division, which was focused on that area of the world, mm-hmm. had potential responsibility now mm-hmm. because of Afghanistan, but at the same time, it was a counterterrorism operation. You had the counterterrorism center
right.
at CIA. How did some of these inter-service rivalries begin to play out and cause problems for the mission moving forward?
Well, it became a problem for me immediately because I was caught between those two divisions. I was actually home base with NE Division, NESA Division, South Asia Division. But I was on a rotational assignment to the Counterterrorism Center when I was overseas as a chief of station. So when I returned and when 9/11 happened, I literally, as soon as the traffic cleared out of Washington, I got in my car, I went to headquarters, CIA headquarters, to say, hey, I'm coming off leave, I'm here, I want to help. Who's going to be running the show here in terms of the response? And they didn't know. And it was some period of time, days anyway, while this was kind of being debated, would it be the Counterterrorist Center, which has the mission of countering terrorism, or any division which had owned the territory where we would be operating against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. So those decisions were made at a very high level. I wasn't sitting in a meeting when those were made, but they're relatively quickly they were made. But initially, no one knew who was actually going to take the lead on the CIA response to 9/11. And so it took a while to play out. And ultimately, the decision was made, well, Counterterrorism Center is going to be taking the lead on this. And NE would play a very important supporting role, of course.
And you were there in limbo trying to volunteer. And
yes.
They couldn't even find your information.
Right, right.
Right.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. It's like, you can't volunteer because you don't technically exist. We don't know where your file is.
Yeah, they couldn't. The new office within Counterterrorism Center, Special Operations, they called it, was wanted volunteers, of course, but they were going to do a special vetting of them to make sure they had the people they wanted. And so I went in, and I was like one of the very, very first people. There were only a handful of people there when they formed it up. And they said, well, we have to vet you. And I said, fine. But then they couldn't find my file. CTC didn't have it. NE Division didn't have it, so they couldn't read my file. But it turned out I knew the person who was appointed to be the chief of the Special Operations Center. And when he came back, he just said, no. We can take them. They didn't bother reviewing my file.
We'll have more of Dwayne in just 1 minute, but let me take a moment to tell you about ZipRecruiter. As I've told you before, ZipRecruiter is a company that was founded by a group of guys who worked in the tech industry and with startups and realized the absolute worst thing about running an organization was the process of hiring people. When we need to hire a new person, we want to get the very best people, and of course, who doesn't? But the process seems never-ending, and it can take a huge amount of time, time we don't have, as we try to run our current operation while planning the content for the new museum. The people at ZipRecruiter have the solution. So are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job, better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within one day. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. So find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. Right now, SpyCast listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/SpyCast. That's ZipRecruiter.com/SpyCast. One more time to try it for free. ZipRecruiter.com/SpyCast.
So let's talk about Afghanistan, because obviously that's kind of the focus here. The CIA didn't just figure out Afghanistan was there on 9/11. They certainly knew about it back in the 80s, but even during the 90s and the early 2000s, there were some contingency planning happening in Afghanistan. There was liaison between CIA and the Northern Alliance. There was constant attempt to keep in contact. But right before 9/11, and this is actually something that maybe people don't know the history of, the top person of the Northern Alliance, the person that we would have immediately reached out to work with, was assassinated by Al-Qaeda.
Masoud was the leader of the Northern Alliance, and 3 or 4 days now, I don't remember exactly when, but he was assassinated by a couple of people posing as journalists who were Al-Qaeda affiliated, and they've been waiting for days and days to see him in their camp up with the Northern Alliance headquarters area. And finally, at the last minute, he said, "Yeah, bring him in, I'll see him." And they had explosives with him, and they killed him. And the problem that it immediately presented was he was this very charismatic, very capable leader of the Northern Alliance. And when he was killed, again, just days before 9/11, and then 9/11 happened, and we had this, as you mentioned, this liaison going with the Northern Alliance, who we then turned to join forces with, but their leader had just been assassinated. And I don't know if it was ever proven or known if it was actually done, that assassination was done as part of the whole plot for 9/11, them anticipating that we would do what we did, which is join forces with them. I don't know. I can't speak to that, but that certainly is a possibility.
I mean, the timing is so coincidental, if not. I mean, that seems extraordinary that it seems like it almost has to be a first shot before 9/11 for that. What I thought, also go back to bureaucracy, because of the kind of the undercurrent here is we want to go, we want to do something about it. You've already talked about the CTCSO, Special Operations. The problem that you lay out was one that I think all of us can appreciate and understand, even if we haven't experienced it ourselves, is that you have a new unit standing up, but no one in other units wants to give up their best people. And you want to go fight the war on terror, you want the best people around, but as leadership throughout CIA, why would you give up your top operators to go with some new unit?
Yeah, that was that, and I say in my book, in fact, I call that a failure of leadership, that where we had so many people, so many senior officers who basically wanted to continue as if nothing had happened in terms of their management of personnel, that when requests were made for their officers to come join our CTCSO, it was we had to fight to get those officers because they're either their chiefs of station or their division chiefs didn't want to give them up. They just didn't recognize, in my view, they didn't recognize that the world had changed with 9/11, that this was not going to be the standard kind of thing that CIA did for a while. We're going to be things are going to change here, and we needed people with, particularly people with had previous military skills, people who had certain language skills that would be applicable for operating in Afghanistan. And there were, frankly, there weren't that many that had that combination of talents. So when we found one, we really wanted him. We really needed him. But yet we often ran into problems with their chiefs or either station chiefs, division chiefs, not wanting to give them up.
Did you perceive it as a belief that
this whole counterterrorism thing was a bit of a blip in the mission, and then eventually it would go back to being normal? How you, the perception of some of the leadership treating you this way?
I certainly didn't see it as a blip. I mean, I knew this was major. This was a game changer.
No, I understand that you did. I'm saying, did you perceive that they were thinking that way, and that's why they were unwilling to give up?
Yeah, I perceived exactly that's what they were thinking. That I even heard comments to that effect. Well, you know, yeah, this is bad, but, you know, it's going to change, and things will get back to normal, and we're still going to have our regular mission. And I heard that sort of talk. So that kind of philosophy was there, and I found it very disappointing. Not everybody was that way. I don't want to give the wrong impression here, but there were enough people that felt that way that did make it difficult to get some of the people we were trying to get. Well, ultimately, I think we got pretty much everybody we wanted, because I think Director Tennant, ultimately, when he got involved in it, he would support what that mission was and CTCSO's request for those personnel, and he would weigh in and we'd get the people eventually.
So you had mentioned already that the lookout was for people who were CIA officers but also had military background, which you fit that role. Mm-hmm. You had been both in Special Forces and in military intelligence, but it had been a while at that point.
Yeah.
Did you have to retrain yourself very, very quickly in the stuff that you'd learned in the past? I know that you flew commercial, which I thought was interesting as well.
Yeah.
And there's a great story of you going through Charles de Gaulle Airport, which you can tell or not. Yeah. You can leave it for people to read in the book if you decide. But when you hit the ground, you're working with people who are currently in special operations,
right,
whether Delta or SF or SEALs. And then people, let's not use the word younger, people who had more recent military experience than you did.
Absolutely.
How high was the learning curve to try to come back and relearn some of those skills that you had before?
Well, I didn't have a lot of time to relearn anything other than we got requalified on... Actually, I think I was already qualified from my previous tour, but I think I did do a requal for weapons training. But that wasn't a big issue. Where I was really in the dark more was with the communications equipment that the military was using, that kind of thing. And so I basically, because we had ultimately in the team that I led, we eventually had a couple of special operators from the military that were detailed to us, that were part of the team. And then we were working jointly with the Special Forces team, an ODA. So I didn't have time to relearn all that. I had to rely on the people who knew those skills. The probably the bigger advantage for me having prior military experience was I understood the environment, you know, being out in the field, that kind of living, the types of things we were having to contend with. It wasn't unfamiliar to me. It'd been a while, but I felt pretty much at home, actually.
Well, you mentioned that. Sorry to interrupt you. I think that was extraordinary, because most people who get deployed to Afghanistan think they're on the moon, because it's such a foreign environment,
right,
for many people who grew up in the United States. And a lot of people actually thought they were going to the desert, which only a small little portion of Afghanistan. But you said it was almost like being at home back in New Mexico, like out going fishing and hunting, you know, you've been.
It was. I felt so comfortable there just because of the natural environment. I mean, it's so familiar to me in terms of just what I saw and felt, how the air felt, how the land looked. Carrying a rifle, that when I was a kid, I grew up, that's what all I did was hunt. And so it was very natural feeling. So I didn't feel like I was in an alien environment at all. In fact, I had to kind of remind myself, hey, this is a war zone. This isn't New Mexico. You're not out hunting quail here.
Let me ask you about your arrival there, because you didn't go directly to Afghanistan, you went to Pakistan.
Correct.
First. And this, again, shows another level of tension, of bureaucratic tension within the CIA, because up until 9/11, or up until right after when you guys showed up to start the operations there, Afghanistan had been controlled by the station in Pakistan. And they didn't quite realize, much as the way people back in headquarters didn't quite realize, that the world had changed as dramatically as it had. Talk a little bit about that tension between not only the chief of station, but more of the deputy chief.
Yeah. Well, I think they understood the significance of what had happened. I think what had changed, and maybe they hadn't really realized it, was that organizationally, when CTCSO was formed up, then all of a sudden their role became different from what it had been. Because previously in Afghanistan, we hadn't had a station in Kabul for years. And so Islamabad, being the closest to Kabul, had taken over. They were basically what we call station in exile. And so for CIA operations, I won't say they controlled Afghanistan, because I don't think you can use that term with Afghanistan. But
even today, you can't use it.
But they've been responsible for running CIA operations activities in Afghanistan up until 9/11, when CTCSO came on. And CTCSO was given the mission of running and managing CIA's response to 9/11 inside Afghanistan. SO was responsible for running that war from the CIA standpoint. And that caused a lot of friction, because I think Station still saw itself as the premier leader in that regard. They were still very important. I do not want to in any way underestimate or underdescribe what the role was for the Station. They played a huge, important role, but they were not in charge any longer. SO was, and that, so there was friction. Even before I got out to Pakistan, there had been plenty of communications back and forth, and the friction was evident in the communications between Islamabad Station and CTCSO, that there was a lot of friction, different ideas about how we should proceed in the war, that kind of thing. And so when I went out there, along with a colleague of mine, when we arrived out there, we were pretty much seen as almost the enemy by certain members of the Station.
I mean, a central figure in Afghanistan at the time was Hamid Karzai. And he's turned into a bit of a controversial figure, because his rise to power was seen as a huge win for the United States and everybody against the Taliban, but his actual reign in charge of Afghanistan was seen as less successful. But you knew Karzai pretty well. You had a closer relationship to Karzai than a lot of other people and just about anybody. Ended up being almost, you could knock on the wall and talk to Karzai. You weren't his roommate, but close enough. Can you describe a little bit about who he was as a man? Because you do describe him in the book, and it's interesting how positive, especially since a lot of the negativity about Karzai has come out since.
Right. I got to know him. It was a brief period that I was actually with him, but I was, like you say, I was literally right next in the room next door, and I was kind of his go-to guy. So I got to spend a lot of time with him during that compacted time frame. And there are other agency officers and others throughout the government who've gotten to know him much better than I did at the time. But I mean, at that moment in time, I did get to know him, and I saw him again later on. But I know about the negative things that have come out about Karzai since. But in my book, even though I wrote that retrospectively, I didn't want that to impact at all how I felt about him at the time. I wanted to portray him as I knew him then, and I was extremely impressed with the man. The guy was, I say this in the book, I knew that I was in the presence of a historical figure when I was around him. He was extremely dedicated, totally focused on freeing Afghanistan of the Taliban. Just a gentleman and not a venal bone in his body. I can't imagine him being personally corrupt. Extremely brave. The man had already gone into Afghanistan by himself to initially start this rebellion against the Taliban. So I had nothing but respect for Karzai at the time, and genuinely liked him. And I think most people, I don't know anyone who didn't like him. Over time, as the president in Afghanistan, there's been different things that have been said about him, and I wasn't working with him then. And I've got to say, though, he had a tough row to hoe when you think about it. I mean, he's trying to balance all the conflicting interests in Afghanistan and be the leader of his own country. So sometimes when he would make a decision that we as Americans might not like, I think we were failing to realize, wait a minute, he's in charge of his own country. He's trying to act in the best interest of his country. So he's trying to balance all this. So I can't imagine how he did the job. I think he was in it for 12 years.
Oh, and running a country that's never really been a country.
Exactly.
We'll hear more about Foxtrot Team in a moment, but first let me tell you a little about Casper. When I wake up in the morning, I know almost immediately how my day is going to be based on how well I slept. I think many of us are in the same boat on this. A lousy night's sleep makes for a grumpy Vince. Well, more grumpy than normal. Casper gets this too, and the company was created because better sleep makes for better living. Casper is a sleep brand that created an outrageously comfortable mattress sold directly to consumers, eliminating commission-driven inflated prices. Its award-winning sleep service is developed in-house has a sleek design, and is delivered in a small, how did they do that size box? In addition to the mattress, Casper also offers an adaptive pillow and soft, breathable sheets. Casper brings quality. An in-house team of engineers spent thousands of hours developing the Casper. It combines supportive memory foams for a sleep surface that's got just the right sink and just the right bounce. Plus, its breathable design sleeps cool to help you regulate your temperature throughout the night. Casper also brings convenience. Buying a Casper mattress is completely risk-free. Casper offers free delivery and free returns with a 100-night home trial. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it. The Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars, it's quickly become the internet's favorite mattress. And this is not just on a random site. We're talking about Casper, Amazon, and Google reviews. And again, free shipping and returns to both the United States and Canada. Try Casper now for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, again, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. The Casper is designed, developed, and assembled here in the United States. So today, get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/spycast and using the code SPYCAST. That's casper.com/spycast and use the code SPYCAST. Terms and conditions apply.
Karzai went in with a team called Echo Team.
Correct.
Which you were supposed to be on, but you got bumped at the last minute, literally on the last minute, because of space. I mean, sometimes, again, history happens because a helicopter or a plane can't hold enough people.
That's correct.
And you, at that point, end up leading the team called Foxtrot Team, which the title of the book. And so Karzai goes in with Echo Team. You instead are matched up with another Afghan who gets the nickname the Gucci Muj. Let's talk a little bit about him, because I'm not sure he could be any more different than Hamid Karzai.
Definitely a different personality, clearly a different man. But this is a guy called Gul Aga Shirzai, and he had been the governor in Kandahar up until the Taliban had taken over, and he was, you know, had to flee Kandahar governorship, and he'd been living in exile in Pakistan for a number of years. And that's where the moniker, the Gucci Muj, came from. People thought, well, he's saying he wants to go back and fight the Taliban, but is he really up to the task to do that? And he had to prove himself. That was kind of the idea. And he did. He had gone into country and set up a base just inside Afghanistan, and had an armed group of guys and some equipment, and basically showed some capabilities, some capacity for engaging Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And that's when the decision was made, kind of late. You know, Karzai takes off with the Echo Team. They go in, and then the next day I'm called back to Islamabad and said, hey, we're going to do this other team. And although that had been talked about for some time, about joining up with Shirzai. But then it was like, yeah, we want to do this other team, and you got 4 days to do it.
Right.
You know.
So. Well, it was the abbreviated deployment time, and my next question was going to be about the Foxtrot Team. Is there severe limitations you have going in? Not only do you have very little time to prepare for this, but everything from your communications to weapons to everything else is very ad hoc.
Yeah.
Very much scrap it together when you can find it.
Correct.
Kind of things. Can you talk a little bit about the problems you ran into? Because not only is Shirzai different philosophically than Hamid Karzai, they couldn't be two different people. I mean, Karzai is a relatively small, somewhat, you probably think of him as a, meek is the wrong word, I'm looking for a better word, the humble, and then Shirzai is larger than life, figuratively
kind of
and
a burly
literally.
Kind of guy.
Yeah. Exactly. So how difficult was it, number one, to get Foxtrot Team put together with all the limitations that you had, but number two, to deal with that kind of a personality that was so different than Hamid Karzai?
Yeah, and one of the differences, too, is language. Karzai, of course, speaks beautiful English, probably better than mine, and Shirzai spoke no English, it was Pashto, and we had no Pashto speakers amongst us, so we had to use an interpreter, a first cousin, his great guy, who I call Khalil in the book, to be, he's always, if I want to talk to Karzai, I'm talking through Khalil, to talk to him. So you got that difference there that makes it a different relationship, because I can't speak to him in my own native language. That's a big important factor. A lot of people forget about that. The language is something to consider. His personality was he was more of a physical kind of guy, hands-on kind of guy. Well, Karzai is more of an intellectual, more sophisticated in the way he thought about things and how he acted. But as far as throwing together the team, it was kind of difficult. But what we ended up doing, we had no communications gear, and it's kind of initially they said, no, you got no comms gear, and I was like, well, how am I going to help anybody if I can't talk to anybody? But we managed to scrape together some communications equipment. I had my weapons from having gotten them from Echo Team, but one of the guys that was coming with me, Mark, who was coming out of Islamabad Station, he had no weapons. In the station, had issued all their handguns out, so they thought. But then we finally, through digging through shelves and climbing up on the rafters, found a handgun for him at least. And so he had to get us. He couldn't get an AK-47 until he got in country and got one from one of Shirzai's guys. But so just some basic stuff, and the comm will be most important. And
well, for Mark, probably the weapon might.
Right. Yeah.
Mark, we're sending you to Afghanistan without a gun. Yeah. Good luck.
Yeah. He wasn't too thrilled about that, but we got that worked out, and then we found two special military task force that was there in Islamabad. Two guys who were like the advanced element for it. We got them assigned, detailed, which was a miracle, frankly. Detailed to, again, bureaucracy, detailed to our team. And I say that because we had to get Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld's signature for those two guys to come in with us into Afghanistan. But we needed them because they had the comms gear we needed, at least for part of the comms gear.
Well, let me ask you about that relationship, because that's, I think, very interesting to me about the CIA and Special Operations had been working a little bit together before 9/11, but 9/11 changes everything. Mm-hmm. Where that line that used to be pretty thick, the demarcation between the military, special operations, and CIA, is completely gone.
Yeah.
And really, this is the beginning of that melding of forces. So how was the relationship between CIA and special operations? And did the separate commands, the separate rules of engagement, separate bureaucracies, did they cause hiccups along the way?
Well, you know, in those initial months or weeks and months, I would say it was almost seamless. And I think the whole reason it was almost seamless was simply because we were all so motivated, you know, just like back here at home. Think of how the people came together after 9/11. Same thing, but even more so with the military and CIA in Afghanistan. We knew what our mission was. So people didn't, you know, there was really no friction on the ground. On the ground level, I was with Special Forces team was with my team. We never had any conflict at all. And that was because we were so mission focused. But the agency had, you know, we have a paramilitary arm that are mostly made up of, almost entirely made up of guys from the military services, many of them from different special operations elements of the military. So they're very familiar with the military. They still have friends in those arms and things like that. And so our paramilitary, most of those teams in the initial part of going into Afghanistan, they were made up of our paramilitary officers. So they're very like-minded with their military colleagues that they were working with. They have the same training, the same everything. The difference is they have a little bit of a different mission at that point. Our mission is intelligence collection, providing intelligence, providing supplies. We have other capabilities as well, but in this case, working like with the Special Forces guys, their mission primarily was to bring in close air support to support the Afghans who were fighting on the ground.
Right.
So, but even so, we all understood each other's role, and that was critical, I think. We understood each other's role, so there wasn't friction. You know, they're not saying, oh, they're stepping on our toes, or we're saying we're stepping on their toes. We knew what we were supposed to be doing.
Well, while that didn't have friction, that moved smoothly, there was some friction between the people on the ground and headquarters back in Langley or in the Pentagon. And several times in the book, you discuss the perception, the disconnect in understanding between people back at headquarters and people in the field. They say that different worlds, you can use that phrase in the book. And then there's something, you talk about close air support. There's an anecdote in the book about where you were calling in to do a report back to headquarters, and your colleague had been calling in very close air support. And the person on the other end that you were talking to didn't understand what was happening, thought you had dropped coffee versus a bomb. And then there's the horse feed story, which I want you to tell.
Okay.
And the idea that when someone at CIA died, they used the word shocked in response. And it's like, how far away from the battlefield are they when they don't realize that this is a battlefield?
Yeah.
That someone is going to probably die, and more people probably will fall in that also.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a natural thing that happens between any field element and a headquarters element. They're in different worlds, and sometimes you know those two worlds never don't gel very well. But in the case of the close air support incident you mentioned, and I was, again, for a while, the combo gear I had, even though we got the military guys with us, it was only good for secure voice communications. I couldn't send any text. So every report I sent, I had to dictate it. And you know, I'm in a tactical environment, and I had to dictate every report. Where normally you'd type it up and shoot it through a satellite. Well, in this case, I had to do a satellite comms, but dictate it. And that was it's the middle of the night for me. It was like 2 a.m. For headquarters, it's 2 p.m. roughly. And so they're they're in different worlds, literally in that sense. And in that case, we were calling. I wasn't, but the SF team leader in that moment was calling in close air support on some convoys that were coming on us. And one, I don't know where it hit, but it was really loud. And I was, it was, I jumped. It was so loud. And but the lady I was talking to on the other end, she said, "What was that? Did you drop your coffee cup?" I'm like, I didn't even answer her. I didn't really tell her what happened. I just, continued on. But and then the horse feed, another example. A lot of the teams were operating in the north, and they actually did use horses up there. And I really was mad that I didn't have a team that had horses, because I grew up with horses. And
I would have really felt
like New Mexico. But so I was really, upset about that. Not really upset, but it would have been kind of cool. But anyway, what happened though? One day when we'd get air supplies, would be dropped by via parachute to us, and we'd have to go out and inventory what they sent us, what they had dropped to us, and send a report back, and. Well, one day when it's actually at night when they drop them, we got our supplies, we're unloading them, and lo and behold, there's 2 bags of horse feed, and so we do our report, and I have to check everything before it goes out, because it's going out basically under my signature, so to speak, and everything looks good, looks good, and it was just a routine report about what we'd received, so I probably didn't pay a lot of attention to what it said actually, and so but after I sent the message. To headquarters, I was looking at our log sheet, looking at the different messages, and I was reading it. And what it had said, what someone, it wasn't me, one of my teammates, probably one of the paramilitary guys that was with us, had put, just to make sure headquarters understood, we didn't have any horses. When we put 2 bags of horse feed, they put in parentheses, they said, "We don't have any effing horses." but they didn't say effing. And that was a big deal, because you'd never, ever use profanity in official CIA communications. You just don't. And here I am looking at this cable that supposedly I sent, that I wrote that, and I sent it out, and my headquarters is looking at this. So
there's going to be some historian in 80 years telling the story of Afghanistan going through these documents. That'll give them a good chuckle. But what's amazing to me is, despite all of this, despite the bureaucratic snafus and the fact that Foxtrot was thrown together at the last minute, you actually were the first group into Kandahar.
Yeah, we were.
That was the ultimate target of several of these operations, and Foxtrot was the first team in. And you hunkered down at the governor's palace, and you actually were able to go back and leave the paramilitary aside and do some hardcore intelligence work once you got there. Can you talk a little bit about the take from the governor's palace in Kandahar?
Yeah. Well, a couple of things I would like to say. Yes, we were the first team in, and I'm very proud of that. However, Echo Team came in, basically half the team came in the next day and the next day after that. And the reason we were going to hit Kandahar at the same time, but they had just a few days before had been hit by an errant bomb. And it killed a number of people, to include 2 of the SFers that were with Echo Team working with us when I was there before I got switched over to Foxtrot, and wounded everyone else on the ODA. So they had been delayed. They had, Karzai himself was injured in that bombing. So they were delayed a bit, but they came down. They were there the next day. But we were
I was
the first.
Giving you a chance to take a victory lap.
I know. And also, I gotta say, it wasn't the CIA guys, Foxtrot. It was also the Special Forces ODA that entered the town the same time as we did. So it wasn't just us. You know, there were others involved in that. But anyway, you mentioned now I forgot your question about the compound. We were in the compound.
You got a chance to do some real hardcore intelligence collection.
Yeah, headquarters had already prepared a list of places they want us to raid there in Kandahar. That's where Al Qaeda had been kind of headquartered there. That was kind of a main sanctuary for them. And so we were hoping we were going to maybe capture someone. We actually captured some Al Qaeda, captured or killed some Al Qaeda on the way to Kandahar. In the village of Takhtapul that we held for about 10 days when we were trying to get into Kandahar and had to get past the airport there in Kandahar because it was being held by the bad guys. And once we were able to get moved past, we got in Kandahar and we started going after those targets that we had, those buildings and houses that headquarters had said to go raid. And we were hoping to either capture more guys, we figured they're probably gone by now, or at least get some intel out of it. And we actually did get some intel. No question, the most important thing we got out of it was basically a casing report and attack plan to attack a U.S. naval ship, the Carl Vinson, in Singapore by an Al Qaeda affiliated cell in Southeast Asia, and they casing report, photos, video, diagrams, everything, and this was going to be something like on the scale of the Cole.
Except the Carl Vinson is not the coal. The Carl Vinson is a massive, nuclear-powered aircraft carrier.
Right. It's a different ship. That's true. But it's that sort of.
But I'm saying it could have been catastrophic beyond the level. I mean, of the coal.
And so that report got out, immediately, of course. And it took a few weeks, but they basically rounded up everybody in Southeast Asia. That whole cell was wrapped up. So that I feel like that above probably any single thing. Was made it all worthwhile for them to form a Foxtrot team to send it in because we don't know how many sailors would have been killed. There's also a lot of other targets they were looking at in Singapore, international targets that they were going to go after as well.
And then people may know the name Jose Padilla as well, and some of the intelligence take, although you didn't know it at the time,
right?
What you got actually helped to lead to
that is correct. Al Qaeda, believe it or not, they're very very bureaucratic in their keeping notes and things like that and keeping track of things, and they have an application form essentially for people who want to apply to become an Al Qaeda member, and so they had he had applied, and we had boxes of stuff that we got in this in the governor's compound, which has been held by Al Qaeda and Taliban before we moved in there, there was still stuff they hadn't gotten rid of, and we found that, and we didn't know if that was in there, but it turned out that was his application form, had his fingerprints on it, and that was used in trial. In fact, Mark, who did the sorting and all that, testified in his trial in disguise and alias as to the chain of custody of that information. That was part of the things that he was convicted on.
So if you're starting your own terrorist organization, leave the bureaucracy behind, have a streamlined approach to your application process. We've talked a ton about bureaucracy, but one of the times the CIA and everybody else actually gets out of your way is arguably the most important, and that's when you now have two Afghan leaders in the same city brought in by two different teams, Hamid Karzai by Echo Team and then Sherzai by Foxtrot Team, who are essentially rivals in many ways, and the rift had to be inevitable at that point. And instead of telling you what to do from Langley, you actually were asked to mediate and given power to try to to solve this problem.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there was always some tension there because they were opposed. They were coming into the same objective, Kandahar, right? And for Sherzai, for him, it was coming back to take his governorship. That's what he was after, to take his governorship back. Karzai, of course, we were looking even then. We were hoping that he would come out on top of everything and be the future leader of Afghanistan, but so there's, and Sherzai knows this as well. So there's some friction there on their different roles and all that, and even though they actually have a familiar relationship. I think they're second cousins or maybe first cousins, but they are related. But so what happened was when we finally took Kandahar, then Karzai kind of assumed primacy. Before he'd been nominated, before he became the actual leader of Afghanistan, he kind of took charge in a way, in a sense, and he was willing to, he wanted the former governor, Taliban governor of Kandahar, then he wanted him to become like a kind of a security chief of Kandahar province to help, he felt that that guy would help breach and bring in Taliban elements to lay down their arms and this kind of thing. So he had a reason for he wanted to do this. But Sherzai hated this guy. There was no way. And also we had intelligence that he was helping him, or he was helping the Al-Qaeda guys who were still in hiding get out of country and get out of Kandahar. So Sherzai was like, no way is he going to become the provincial security chief. You know, not going to happen. And so there was this real friction. And this was so important that they stay united, because these are both of them are Pashtuns. Taliban is made up of Pashtuns. And these are anti-Taliban Pashtuns. So we could not afford for them to be a split between them.
Something like 40% of the population of Afghanistan is Pashtun as well. So
correct.
That could break basically the entire country apart.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So the we had to kind of lay the law down, so to speak. And Greg, the ECHO team leader, who was very close to Karzai at that point, especially after all they had been through, and myself with Sherzai, as well, I brought Mark along, because Mark was from Islamabad station, and he knew Sherzai as well, and I wanted him to be there. So we go to this meeting between the two to kind of sort things out. And basically, we were just told, hey, guys, you know, you got to come to an agreement here. You can't, this is for the good of the country. You've got to get this thing resolved. And to his credit, Karzai said, well, let me do my own checking into this reporting about the guy helping the guy he wanted to appoint as the chief of security, helping Al-Qaeda get out of Kandahar. And he used his own sources, and he was able to confirm what we were telling him. And at that point, he said, that's fine, we're not going to appoint him to the chief of security. And at that point, Sherzai was happy, and it was all resolved.
Until 10 minutes later when Afghanistan...
Yeah.
Before we wrap up this conversation, let me ask you a question. How many emails do you have in your inbox right now? 100? 1,000? 20,000? If your email is anything like mine used to be, the answer is too many. But here's the thing. Even though I know I want to do something about it, I didn't know how. I knew I'd miss something important if I just deleted them all, although that would be a glorious moment. But there were too many emails to go through one at a time. Then I finally learned the secret to reaching inbox zero and taking back my email sanity. It's called Sanebox, and I can't recommend it enough. Sanebox sorts through your email and moves all the trivial stuff to a different folder, so the only messages in your inbox are the ones you actually want to see. Aside from removing all the junk so you can focus on messages that matter, there's this really cool feature called the black hole. Move an email into that folder and you'll never hear from the sender again. It's so good. There's also Sane Reminders, where Sanebox will automatically remind me when I need to do a follow-up email, so nothing falls through the cracks. You can also snooze emails, which is a great way to defer or de-emphasize less urgent emails, and I can read them later. Sanebox works on top of your existing setup. You don't need to change your habits by creating a new email account or downloading a new app. Sanebox just makes your existing one awesome. Because we could all use more organization in our life, we worked out a great deal for our listeners. Visit sanebox.com/spycast today, and they'll throw in an extra $25 credit on top of the 2-week free trial. You don't even have to enter your credit card information unless you decide to buy, so there's really nothing to lose. Check it out today and let me know if you love the black hole and reaching inbox zero as much as I do. Again, that's sanebox.com/spycast. So let me, before we jump out to questions, which we are, so start thinking about that now. It's been 16 years. Mm-hmm. We're still there. It doesn't look like it's getting significantly better. Right. Based on your experiences, can we have peace in Afghanistan without including the Taliban, whether it's big T Taliban or little T Taliban or however we want to define this? And is there a military solution that we haven't somehow been able to find in the last 16 years? What is your prognosis for Afghanistan moving forward?
Well, I first don't believe there is a military solution there. I don't think, unless we wanted to just completely turn into much larger than what we did before with 100,000 troops. And I don't think anyone's ready to do that, or wants to do that, or that we should do that. So I do not think there is a military solution to the problems in Afghanistan. I was very hopeful right after December 2001. We had had this pretty good success there. The Taliban was out of office. They were on their heels. I thought that there would be a chance to get the country up on running and unified and have a kind of a stable country. But I'm not nearly as hopeful any longer. And you know, you got to look at the history behind the country. And this is nothing, what's going on now is nothing new. It's been going on a long, long time. And I think it's Einstein who said, you know, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result, is a definition of insanity. And I think we got a little bit of that going on in Afghanistan. We were hopeful, we had good intentions, but it's a tough country. It's a primitive country. It's a geographically isolated country and ethnically divided. It has so many internal type divisions. It manages when it's not, doesn't have foreign forces in there. It seems to get along okay. It seems to manage itself pretty well. It has historically, and it comes together typically when there's a foreign invasion, like with the Russians or the Persians or the Mongols or
the British.
Or the British.
Four or five
yeah,
times,
they
yeah.
they end up turning against. Now, they haven't, as a nation, done that to us, to the United States yet. And I think that's partly because we've gone about this a little bit smarter. But I think as it goes, the longer it goes, the greater risk we run of that happening. So I don't think there's a military solution. I say in my book at the end, you know, the only solution is a negotiated peace. But unfortunately, I don't think the Taliban are right now in any position they're going to want to negotiate. But I do think we need to be thinking about leaving Afghanistan, not getting up and hightailing out immediately, but we need to give up on the idea that we are going to build this nation into a stable country.
Was it winnable in December of 01 and 2002?
I think, you know, I really think where we got off track, I think our best hope, actually, of making it from the nation-building standpoint, stability, political stability and all that, was really those first couple of years. But unfortunately, I think the U.S. screwed up when we invaded Iraq. At that point, and I can speak to this because I was in a job at headquarters then dealing with Afghanistan, and all the focus of the government basically really went to Iraq, and we went into a hold position in Afghanistan in terms of the resources and all that. We were still trying to do stuff. But if we had not invaded Iraq, if we'd been able to keep focused on Afghanistan, especially after those initial success we had in 2001, I think that would have been our best opportunity to be able to stabilize the place and be gone, or be mostly gone. And unfortunately, that opportunity has come and gone, and I don't think we're going to get it back.
So we're going to open it up to questions from the audience. If you will wait to ask your question until either Sean or Amanda, they'll have a microphone. But if you have a question, please raise your hand. Right down here, Sean is coming behind you with the mic.
Thank you. Can you talk a little bit about the federally administered tribal areas and when that became an issue of complication on how to get control over that area and how it became an escape point for folks to get into?
Well, that area, of course, is a lot of people refer to that like a no man's land. And it's the, you know, Pakistani government has you know, kind of, it's an autonomous region. They pretty much kept their forces out of that. But what happened is because everything, you know, I'm not a historian. I don't want to pretend I'm a historian here. But where it became a real issue was with the Taliban, Al Qaeda, some of the Chechens that were coming into the area, and so that they could go into those tribal areas, leave Afghanistan, go into those tribal areas, and there it was, they were pretty much not going to be, you know, attacked at that point early on. That changed. The Pakistanis actually started doing some aggressive military offensive operations into the tribal areas. But, you know, those are very remote areas. It's Pashtuns. And, you know, a lot of people think we ought to just erase that border and kind of make on either side of the border, just call that Pashtun land. And forget, because the Pashtuns that live there, right there by the border, they don't really respect that border because to them it's a very artificial thing. So, I really can't speak to it other than to say that because it was kind of a no man's land in a way, that the government of Pakistan did not try to intervene militarily there until things got really bad. And they did start intervening there when, again, a lot of the foreign fighters were coming in there. And then also some of this bled over into Pakistan, wasn't just affecting Afghanistan. But the whole Pakistan issue is what really is one of the other major complications to to the whole situation in Afghanistan, because the border's pretty porous, because of the PAC's their what they perceive as their strategic interest in that in Afghanistan, it just really complicates the whole idea of trying to come up with some kind of peaceful settlement in the region.
Well, I think a lot of people have focused on, you know, they know the story of the Kurds and the fact that the Kurds are like four different countries.
Right.
Pashtuns, same basic. I mean,
yeah.
I think with the historically with the breakup of, you know, the British Empire in South Asia, mm-hmm. there was this attempt to create, I guess, a Pashtunistan mm-hmm. That would be both in Pakistan and Afghanistan
yeah.
because they see themselves as tribe before country. In
right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. They do.
Yes, here in front. She's coming right behind you.
So it's my understanding that the present administration somehow thinks that the strategic interest of the Pakistanis can be aligned with our interest. I'm just curious about your assessment of that. Do you think that's correct, that could actually occur? And I don't even know, what are the strategic interests of the Pakistanis as it relates to Afghanistan?
Well, they're probably their biggest concern from a foreign national security standpoint is India. India is, in fact, their number one security concern. And Afghanistan is seen as a buffer state, if you will, and they don't want the Indians having a lot of influence in Afghanistan. And that's why, you know, President Trump the other day mentioned in a speech the idea that first kind of chastising the Pakistanis and then saying, welcoming the idea of Indians investing more in Afghanistan. That had to get the Pakistanis' attention. But that's their strategic interest is minimizing the influence of India in that region, and specifically in Afghanistan. But as far as aligning, I mean, there are some places where, yeah, our strategic interests should align with Pakistan. We want Pakistan to be a stable country, and, you know, it's armed with nuclear weapons. We don't want terrorists running around their country that maybe get their hands on those weapons. So, and I don't think the PAC government wants that either. So that's one area that we can, you know, I can all agree on. Where it gets kind of dicey is just for historical reasons and the PAC government involvement in the efforts in Afghanistan, which we were working with them on back during the day when the Russians had invaded, and we were supplying the Mujahideen with arms, and that we were doing that basically through the Pakistani government, of course, through their ISI, their intel service, and they have a long connection to a lot of the Taliban elements, the Haqqani network that they had worked with over those years. And so there's this idea that there's this residual feeling of support people who support these groups still within the government. They're, you know, the PACs, I think, have tried to actually minimize that and weed out people they think are actively supporting them. But I don't know. I'm not involved in that anymore, but that's always been a concern, that the PACs are still somehow, through their service, supporting some of these players in Afghanistan that we are at war with.
All the way in the back.
The Taliban had a disproportionately negative impact on women. How do you think the role of women, do you see any of that during Foxtrot? I know the U.S. government is spending a lot of money right now building empowerment strategies for women.
Well, I can tell you, I didn't see a single woman my entire time in Afghanistan. Not one. They're just not allowed to be anywhere where especially a foreigner might see them. So I didn't see them. And I will say that I do think that there are some statistics, if you will, some research that shows that one good thing about our involvement in Afghanistan, and not just us, but the other countries have been involved in Afghanistan, that more women are, and more children, girls, are going to school than there were. So there's been some progress there. I think the problem will be in the future going forward is if the Taliban either ultimately does take control or if there's some kind of agreement reached where they become part of the government and are willing to do that, that they're going to fight against that just because of their traditional beliefs about the role of women and that kind of thing. So, you know, it's going to be a long, hard road, I think, you know, on a lot of fronts, but certainly on the idea of, you know, equal rights for women, education for girls, But some progress has been made. That's one of the, I think we should feel proud about that having happened in Afghanistan. So it hasn't all, even if we left tomorrow, it wouldn't all be a loss. There's been some progress. Their health is overall better. But going, making more progress, it's going to be hard.
Let's go to the back there also.
Let me thank you for a really interesting presentation. But I have a few questions. The first question is regarding the role of Russia in Afghanistan. Early on, obviously, they were helping with planes coming in, et cetera. Is that ongoing? And the American presence in Russia, as the relationships become more problematical, are they starting to create more problems for the United States in that case? And maybe you can talk about that. And the second question is Iran, obviously. Iran has quite tense relationships with, often with the Taliban, but, also tense relationships with the United States. How do you see that complexity, geopolitical and geostrategical, playing out going forward? And do you believe, ultimately, to help solve the problem in Afghanistan, that better relationships would ultimately also be need to be realized, or some common understandings come to with both Russia and Iran? And maybe talk about China too. So thank you.
Yeah, I can't really speak so much to the whole Russian current. You're talking current involvement of Russia in Afghanistan, and they're trying to gain influence in the country. I really am not in a good position to comment one way or other on that. I think that it's certainly, they've had a historical interest in Afghanistan. As we know, it probably their invasion there and then their leaving there probably resulted in the demise of the Soviet Union. So they have a long-term historical connection to Afghanistan, and they may see this as there are there's some wealth in Afghanistan in terms of some natural resources, and so they may want to gain influence there and try to have just more influence in the region in general going through Afghanistan. But I can't answer your question very well on the whole Russian front aspect. As far as the UN and the Americans, we often conflict with the UN or are not on the same sheet of music when we're trying to do things. I think you're absolutely right in that, if we're any kind of situation like an Afghanistan situation, if we are there in a big way and the UN is there in a big way, it's all the better if we are really coordinating what we're doing and make sure we're not undermining each other there. But beyond that,
I mean, when you were there, were you cognizant of any of the larger regional tensions between Sunni Shiite and any separations?
Of course, Iran was basically an enemy of the Taliban. Iran actually offered to help us after the 9/11 attacks because they were, the Taliban is not a Shia organization. Oh, they're Sunni and they're Wahhabis and so there's a natural, and they're also not. They're not Persians, so there was a natural conflict there between them, and the Iranians actually were willing to help us out a bit there in the initial part. Things have changed now. Part of that, and they are certainly, there's a lot of news reports anyway about the Iranians trying to get involved in Afghanistan and giving support to one group or another. And again, I trace that back, frankly, to the invasion in Iraq. When we eliminated Saddam Hussein, that was Iran's strategic counterbalance in the region. When he went away, we shouldn't be surprised that the Iranians are now gaining a lot of influence in the region. We just took out one guy, leader, who could kind of held them in place. So that has come back to haunt us in a lot of ways, I feel.
Time for one last question right down here in front.
Yeah. Sir. Yeah. You mentioned how you reached out and the importance of Pashtun elements. To what extent did you reach or try to reach the non-Pashtun groups, and what problems did you have with coordinating between the Pashtuns, the Tajiks, Hazaras, and others?
Yeah, We the only group we had that wasn't Pashtun with us was we had a group of Hazaras, which I thought was great. I was so excited about that because they speak Dari, and I used to speak Farsi, which is kind of the same language. So I was really looking forward to talking to them in that language. But it turns out they have such a thick accent, and that it was they would laugh at my speaking to them. But so they were the only group other than Pashtuns that I worked with. Now, but in the north, that was the Northern Alliance was made up primarily of Tajiks and Uzbeks, and even some Pashtuns were part of the Northern Alliance as well. And there, I'm not sure if there were any Hazaras. There were some Hazaras with the Northern Alliance. So we had a relationship with all those, the agency did anyway, through those teams that were up there operating with the Northern Alliance. They were each team, basically up north, the way it worked is our teams would work with one of the major commanders within the Northern Alliance. And they were doing the same thing with those guys up in the Northern Alliance. They had an army up there, the Northern Alliance. They had tanks, helicopters, artillery, all that. We were doing the same thing in the south, although we didn't have an army to work with. We just had basically guerrilla groups is what we were doing. But we had relationships with those, and they did, they knew, we tried to pass information back and forth so that the Northern Alliance guys knew what was going on in the south, and we knew what was going on in the north, that kind of thing. But we weren't directly dealing with it where I was, with any of the other ethnic groups.
Well, please join me in thanking Duane Evans for taking the time to talk to us here today.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution. To help support future educational programming, please visit spymuseum.org and click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page. We'd like to thank ZipRecruiter, Casper, and Sanebox for the continued support of SpyCast. Remember, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, by going to ZipRecruiter.com/SpyCast. You can also get $50 toward any mattress purchased by visiting casper.com/spycast and using the code SPYCAST. And visit sanebox.com/spycast today, and they'll throw in an extra $25 credit on top of the already free 2-week trial. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.